Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back. And after 2 weeks in Toronto, I always have the same wish and the same hope. My prayer for Eretz Yisrael is that Canada, I always say it, I said it in my shul after the elections, Canada is the most boring country in the world. If you don't read the newspaper for a month, you haven't missed a thing. If you don't hear the radio for a year, nothing's changed. Did I tell you last time in August when I was, I must have told you this, when I was in Toronto in August, one of the newspapers, I see a big headline, a headline that shook me up. Headline said, defense deteriorates, Canadians jittery. So I wonder what's going on. Defense deteriorates, Canada jittery. Who are they at war with? What's the problem? So I grabbed the paper and I start reading the article. The Montreal Canadiens, that's a hockey team, their defense was deteriorating, and therefore all Canadians are jittery. I cut this out, it was on the fridge. That's where all important things are. It was on the fridge for about 2-3 months until I took it down right before we went to Canada. So my wish is, my tefillah is that Eretz Yisrael should be as boring as Canada. Over here, any little thing that happens in Eretz Yisrael is world news. World news. Hebron is world news. I think every major or minor TV station has their photographers in full time in Hebron. The whole world focuses on Hebron. In Canada, there's nothing to focus on. There's nothing going on over there. Nothing going on. What a blessed place. Yeah. So, Mietz Hashem, Eretz Yisrael should be as boring as Canada. All right. Back. Shir. Parshat Vayishlach. There is going to be a segment of this morning's shiur that will be a takeoff on one of the shiurim in Nevi'im that I said a while ago on Wednesday, because I feel that it's going to explain a lot of difficult parts of not only this parasha, but all of the parashiyot, beginning with Toldot, the story of the two brothers, Yaakov and Esav, and most particular, what I'm concerned about is Yaakov. Something has happened to Yaakov. It's not the same Yaakov in Parshat Vayishlach, this coming week, Sedra. What's the Sedra about? The Sedra is about the confrontation between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov comes home and he meets up with 400 men led by Esav, armed to the teeth. And he prepares himself for war. He sends a gift, not of appeasement, but a gift that is extending a hand of peace to his brother Esav. He prays to God, and there is that mysterious nocturnal struggle with an angel from which Yaakov emerges at morning limping, but he has prevailed. He has prevailed. Yaakov's name is changed from Yaakov to Yisrael. He really remains Yaakov and Yisrael. And as I think of it now, we may, with what we're going to say during the course of the shiur, we may be able to explain why his name remains both Yaakov and Yisrael. What's he doing on the other side of the river there? He's on the other side of the river, and it says, Vayivater Yaakov levado. Yaakov remained alone. Strangely enough, our rabbis in the Gemara say, and Rashi brings it, that he went back for pachim ketanim. He had left some small jars and jugs, you understand. Yaakov Avinu, the patriarch, goes back across the river in order to pick up pachim ketanim, small jars. And then, of course, he meets up with his brother Esav. He emerges from that confrontation, and their ways part. And Yaakov continues until he comes to the city of Shechem. He comes to Shechem. So in chapter 33, Pasuk 18, it says, "Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem." Yaakov came complete. Rashi says he was healed. He had been limping after his confrontation with the angel. Yaakov comes healed to the city of Shechem, Asher Beretz Canaan, that is in the land of Canaan, Bevarobi, Padan Aram, when he comes back from Padan Aram, Vayicham et Pnei Ha'ir, and he graces the face of the city. Vayichan really means, comes from the word chen, from the word chen, to grace. And it also means vayichan, sort of that he settled in. Our rabbis say the following: what did he do in Shechem? In what way did he grace the city? The Gemara says three things. Number one, matbeya tikein lahem. He created for them currency, money. You know, that there should be a means of trade aside from barter. Second, the Gemara says, Merchitzaot tikein lahem. He made bathhouses for them. And the third opinion in the Gemara is, Shvakim tikein lahem. He made marketplaces for them. It seems that Yaakov's contribution to the city of Shechem, his contribution is in the field of the economic, the hygienic, the monetary. He does something for the city. And then he buys a field there. And then, of course, we have the tragedy of Dina, who is raped and held hostage. Shimon and Levi go in and they massacre the city of Shechem. And then maybe another few psukim, and we'll begin to ask a number of the questions that are troubling me. In chapter 35, Vayomer Elokim El Yaakov, God said to Yaakov, chapter 35, Lamed Hei, Vayomer Elokim El Yaakov, God said to Yaakov, Kum Alei Beit El, go up to Beit El, Veshev Shaman, and live there. Vasei Shom Mizbeach, and make an altar there. La El Hanid'a Elecha, to the God who appeared to you when you fled before your brother Esau. Unusual. Here he is. He has settled into Shechem. God tells him, go to Beit El. And this is one of the few places where God tells one of the others to make an altar. Usually the mizbechot that they made of their own volition. Here he's told, go make a mizbeach. Yaakov says to his family, whoever is with him, remove all of the strange gods that are in your midst, and to purify yourselves, change your garments. We're going to go up. We're going to get up and we're going to go up to Beit El. I'm going to make a mizbeach to the God who answers me in the day of my trouble. He was with me on the way in which I went. The Elohei Hanecha that it's referring to, the strange gods, it doesn't mean that they were idolaters, but they had just finished the massacre of the city of Shechem, and they took the spoils. Whatever was in the city, they took with them. Yaakov says, get rid of it all. They go up to Beit El, and he makes an altar over there. What's the meaning of God telling him to go up to Beit El? What's the meaning of the altar? What's the meaning of his telling all the members of his family, get rid of anything that may in some way be idolatrous? But maybe more than that. Let's go back to the very first description the Torah gives us of Yaakov. What's the first description? The twins are born, and back in Parshat Todot it says, Vayigdalu Hana'arim, the boys grew up. Vayihi Esav, Esav was Ish Yodeat Sayid, a man who knows how to hunt. Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. The Yaakov, Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim, and Yaakov is the complete person, the pious person, Yoshev Ohalim, who lives in the tents. What tents does he live in? Says Rashi, the tents of Shem Ve'ever. He was the studious, the bookish, the quiet type. He's the pious one, the religious one. Who is the man of action? Who is the man of the world, the man of the field, the hunter? That's Esav. Two different personalities. Esav, Yaakov. And then, of course, we have even what's a stranger pasuk, that Yitzchak loves Esav, kitzayid b'fiv, because the hunting of Esav is in the mouth of Yitzchak. V'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Rivka loves Yaakov. Well, of course, the questions that are always asked, doesn't Yitzchak know what this fellow Esav is all about? Doesn't he know that Esav is Esav HaRasha? This is a killer. He doesn't know what Esav is. We are left with the impression sometimes when we read the parasha as though Yitzchak doesn't really know what's happening. It's Esav who's pulling the wool over Yitzchak's eyes. He doesn't understand that Esav is really trying to fool him with all of his klutz kashes about how do you give mice from salt and all the rest. And Yitzchak, he can't see anymore, he's growing old, so he's fooled by Esav. And he even wants to give the brachas, the blessings he wants to give to Esav, until of course Rivka is the one who makes certain, she commands her son Yaakov to go in, and through an act of guile and trickery, he takes the blessings. And then of course there's the age-old problem. Yitzchak suspects that this fellow who has come in over here is not really Esav, and therefore he says, "Come over here, my son. I want to feel you." He feels him, and he says, "My Hakol Kol Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, Vahayadayim Yidei Esav, and the hands are the hands of Esav." And then the next pasuk says that he went on to bless him. But wait a minute, doesn't he seem to be left with a doubt over here? Isn't there a question in his mind? 50% the man is Esav, 50% he's Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Yaakov, but the hands are the hands of Esav. So why does he give him the bracha? Then we go through all of Parashat Vayetze. Yaakov flees, spends all of those years, 20 years or so, in the house of Lavan. And then a question that I've dealt with a number of times, and maybe we will have a different look at it this year. I really hope that by the end of this year I'm going to remember to answer all of the questions that I've asked. If not, I will give you permission at 10:15 to ask questions. In other words, you'll ask me then, how did I answer this question and how did I answer that question? The problem that I've dealt with a number of times in Shurim is, last week we read Parashat Vayetze. This week we're going to learn Parashat Vayishlach. And there's a dramatic difference between the end of Vayetze and the beginning of Vayishlach. We don't often notice it because there's a week that goes by between reading the end of Vayetze and beginning Vayishlach. But there's something very strange that happens. At the end of Parashat Vayetze, we talk about Yaakov fleeing from the house of his father-in-law. And his father-in-law finds out that Yaakov has fled. He takes all of his men with him, and they ride across Mesopotamia. And he catches up to him. More than that, I would say he catches Yaakov upon the hills of Gilad. And there's the great confrontation between Yaakov and his father-in-law Lavan. And one of the greatest speeches in all of Tanakh, if not in all of literature, is the great speech of Yaakov, where Yaakov turns to his father-in-law and he says, "Ma pishiyu ma chatasi ki dolakto acharai? What is my sin? What have I done wrong that you pursue me?" And you hear 20 years of frustration and pain pouring out of Yaakov. "I worked for you for 20 years. During the day, the sun burned down upon me, and during the night I froze, and I took care of your sheep. I worked for you with honesty and with dignity and with integrity. Even when there were losses, I never brought the losses to you. I was the one that sustained them myself." Oh, you can hear in the words of Yaakov the feelings, the pain of the exploited throughout all of history, the downtrodden. It's a great speech, one of the greatest of them all. Does the speech have any effect on Lavan? es helft wie ein teuten Bankes. I'm sorry, if you don't understand this, you better learn a great Yiddish statement. Es helft wie ein teuten Bankes. And I will not translate it because I don't have a clue how to translate it. Don't tell me what a teuten Bankes is. It means it's useless, helpless, garnished. And what is it that, what is Lavan's response to this great speech? Habonim bonai, the sons are my sons, habonos benosai, the daughters are my daughters, the chol asher ataro elihu, whatever you see here, it's all mine. The great speech made absolutely no impact on Lavan. Garnished. And if anything, Yaakov is just thrilled that he's able to escape the clutches of his dear father-in-law. That was the end of Parshat Vayetze. What happens at the beginning of Parshat Vayishlach? He finds out that Esav is coming toward him. He immediately acts. He puts his entire camp on a war footing. He divides the camp in two. If Esav is going to come to one, we're going to fight, and at least the other will be able to flee and be saved. We're talking about a Yaakov who's ready to fight. Why wasn't he ready to fight Lavan? Why does he flee from Lavan? He runs like a frightened individual. What's he running from Lavan? And the next day, he stands up to his brother Esav with courage, with strength, with determination. He's ready for war. And then we go through this Parshat Vayishlach, and here is the great Yaakov at the other side of the river. He goes back for some little jars. He comes to the city of Shechem. What does he do for the city of Shechem? So we started by telling you what our rabbi said. He made matbeya, he made currency for them, bathhouses, and a shuk, shvakim tikei lehem, marketplaces. Alright. The way in which I want to approach this, as I said, it was partially a shiur that I gave in Tanakh a few weeks ago, but I believe it's going to explain to us what seem to be the inconsistencies in the personality of Yaakov. Something has happened to Yaakov. Yaakov is no longer that first description of him. We can no longer say now in Parshat Vayishlach that Yaakov is the Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He's the Ish Tam, the meek or the complete, the pious one who's sitting in the tents, the studious one, the bookworm. And by the way, I wonder, maybe we'll throw this into the hopper as another question. Yaakov was a student of Avraham and Yitzchak. He learned Torah from Avraham and Yitzchak. And Yosef Oholim, he was in the tents. What tents was he in? He went to study by Shem and Eva. What could Shem and Eva teach him that he hadn't learned from Avraham and Yitzchak? What was there in the curriculum of Shem and Eva? What did they know more than Avraham and Yitzchak? What did they know more than Avraham and Yitzchak? All right. We have an hour for the answers. Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omeid, the world stands on three pillars. Torah, study of Torah and the fulfillment of mitzvahs of Torah, avoda, service and worship of God, ugmilut chasadim, and acts of kindness between man and fellow man. These three pillars are represented by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but in reverse order. What was Avraham? Avraham was known as the pillar of chesed, kindness. He's the one who made that eshel out in Be'er Sheva open all four sides. Anybody who wanted was welcome to come into the house of Avraham. Avram is the one, though he is sick, he at age 100, he has gone through the process of circumcision, and it's a very, very hot day, and he's sitting there by the entrance to his tent looking for guests, and he goes running out to bring in these three dusty Arabs walking along the road, not knowing, of course, that they are angels. Avram is chesed. Avram is kindness. What is Yitzchak? Yitzchak is avodah. Yitzchak is the ultimate in worship. Here is the one who nearly was the Ola, the sacrifice that is brought before God. He is the Ola Tamima, the complete sacrifice. The one who is the personification of holiness in itself. He is Avodah. He is the pillar of great worship of God. What is Yaakov? Yaakov really is the composite of Avraham and Yitzchak. Because you know what Avraham is? Avram represents a pillar that is completely earthy. Aretz. Chesed is between man and fellow man. It's right here, down here, on the face of this earth. Yitzchak, on the other hand, is one who inhabits the great spheres of the heavens. His relationship with God is a relationship different than anyone else has. Do you know what the entire personality of Yaakov is going to represent? Precisely what it is that he dreams in that great dream of last week, Sedra. What does he dream? He dreams of a ladder that has its feet on the ground going up to the very heavens. Do you know what Avram is? Avram is earth. Yitzchak is heaven. But man lives here. Do you know what Yaakov incorporates within himself? The meeting place of heaven and earth. And the meeting place of heaven and earth, the meeting place of heaven and earth, is not only going to be the personality of Yaakov, that is precisely what Torah represents. In fact, the Balaturim says, Sulam, the ladder, the gematria of Sulam, the numerical value of Sulam is Sinai. Sinai, because what Yaakov sees in the dream is what's going to be accomplished at Sinai. At Sinai, God is going to come down from the heavens. Moshe is going to go up to the top of the mountain. Heaven and earth are going to meet. Avraham and Yitzchak meet in Yaakov. Heaven and earth. Rashi brings the Gemara that says the bottom of that ladder was Be'er Sheva. The top of that ladder was Beit El. The middle of the ladder was over Yerushalayim. You know what Yerushalayim therefore represents? The middle. The path that goes between the Be'er Sheva on earth, the Beit El in the heavens. Yerushalayim represents the middle path. That's what Torah is. The purpose of Torah is to take the mundane and the earthly and sanctify it. In the terms of Kabbalah, Avraham is chesed, Yitzchak is gevura, might, and the two of them join together in Yaakov and they become tiferet. Beauty, glory, dignity, when you can take heaven and earth and bring them together, so that what you're doing is you are adding grace and beauty to the earthy, and you are giving the heavenly, you're giving it body instead of it simply be something, ideas that swim around in the very heavens without anything to give them concrete life. When Torah, when Chesed and Avodah meet, the two of them together, the earthy and the heavenly meeting, each one in a sense influences the other and fructifies the other. The earthy and the earthly become sanctified and made holy, and the heavenly takes on form and shape and body and life by virtue of the fact that there are people who are performing mitzvahs right here, God's word. Heaven and earth meet through Torah. Let's go one step further. The one step further that I want to take you is, and this is the part that I had said in a shir on Navi, in order to explain really Malachim Bet, major part, for that matter, it's a major part of Sefer Malachim is understood this way, and you will see as we go through it. On the 28th day of Iyar, 1904, Rav Kook came on Aliyah. We know the 28th day of Iyar. What is the 28th day of Iyar? That's Yom Yerushalayim, the day on which Yerushalayim was liberated during the Six-Day War. And on that same day, but back in the year 1904, Rav Kook came on Aliyah, and he became Rav. He came to be Rav of Yafo. I don't think there was a Tel Aviv at the time. It was Yafo and the Moshavot around Yafo. There was no Ramat Gan, Gornish, Gornish, no Ramat Chaim, Gornish, nothing. There was Yafo, and there were sand dunes. That's what it was. Most probably one of the many great challenges that he had in his life came less than 2 months later. On the 20th of Tammuz, Theodor Herzl died. And Rav Kook was invited to give a eulogy for Herzl. He knew that this was going to place him in an extremely difficult position, because he would be damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. Because the Yishuv HaYoshan, the Jews of Yerushalayim, would condemn him forever. Go make a hesped for Theodor Herzl. They can't be. Then again, of course, the people who he has to work with would condemn him. Not make a hesped for Theodor Herzl. So here he was caught between, I imagine if he's on the shores by Yafo, it's pushed between the devil in Yerushalayim and the deep blue sea off the coast of Yafo. Rav Kook decided to give the hesped, and the hesped remains an unusual document of such brilliance and such profundity, and it is, well, fortunately or unfortunately, it's so alive today. It's of such contemporary significance. And in addition to the fact that it's of such contemporary significance, I believe it's going to explain to us the personality of Yaakov. What happens to Yaakov from the beginning of Parashas Toldos through Parashat Vayetze and Vayishlach? And I believe with this we will be able, and I'm going to be using what Rav Kook says in a different context in order to explain the personality of Yaakov. And as I say, the contemporary significance is going to be immediately evident. The Gemara in Masechta Megillah, will go step by step. He wants to explain a Gemara in Masechta Megillah. The Gemara says the following. When the Targum, the Aramaic translation of the Nevi'im, was revealed, Nizdaza Eretz Yisrael trembled. All of Eretz Yisrael shook. On Torah, the Targum, the Aramaic translation, was written by Unkelus. There was no Targum for Nevi'im, but then it was written, and when it was written, Eretz Yisrael trembled and shuddered. And God, a voice comes out from heaven. Mi gilo lebonai razeh. Who is the one that revealed this secret to my children? Who did it? Yonatan ben Uziel got up and said, Rabbeinu Shalom, I'm guilty. I am the one who did it. I translated Nevi'im and Ketuvim into Aramaic. Velo lichvodi, velo lichvod Beit Abba. I didn't do it for my own honor and glory, nor for the glory of my family. Ela shelo yirbu machloket b'yisod, that they should not be machloket, division and splintering within the Jewish people. Gemara goes on to explain that there are secrets that were revealed. What were the secrets that were revealed? What secrets were revealed? So the Gemara gives an example. Gemara says the following. Gemara says a pasuk in Zechariah. There's a pasuk in Zechariah that says, "Bayom Hahu, Bayom Hahu, Yigdal HaMispeid B'Yerushalayim K'Mispeid HaDadrimon B'Givat Megidon. Hang in. On that day, Zechariah the Navi describes, on that day there's going to be great mourning in Yerushalayim, like the mourning for Hadadrimon in the valley of Megiddon. So the Gemara says, what's this Hadadrimon? What mourning was there about Hadadrimon in the valley of Megiddo? Says the Gemara, Ilmale Tirguma the High Crow, we would not have had the Targum, what Yonatan ben Uzziel says on that pasuk, we would never understand what the pasuk is talking about. And Yonatan ben Uzziel explains in the Targum that the pasuk is referring to 2 days of great mourning. The first one was the day on which Achav, King Achav, the son of Omri, died on the field of battle. And that's the first word. Hadadrimon. Hadadrimon was a soldier of the attacking forces, attacking Israel, who shot an arrow, and the arrow struck Achav, king of Israel, and he died during the course of the day in his chariot. It seems that was a source of great mourning to the Jewish people. We'll have to understand what kind of mourning there was. Achav was a Rasha. I don't have a better, or for that matter, a worse word with which to describe Achav. And if you can't imagine how big of a Rasha he was, all you have to think about is that he was married to Izebel. That's bad enough. Achav was an Eved Avodah Zarah, an idolater. He was king of one of the kings of the 10 tribes. He was a Rasha. And that was a period of great mourning, the death of Achav. Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel goes on to say that the pasuk in Zechariah is talking about another day of great mourning. Hadadrimon is one, and then there's Bikat Megiddon, the valley of Megiddon. Who died in the valley of Megiddon? There was a king of Yehuda by the name of Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu was a great tzaddik. And Yoshiyahu, it says about him, there were none before him who returned to God with all of their heart and with all of their soul, as Yoshiyahu did. During the days of Yoshiyahu, Paro, the forces of Egypt, in their struggle against Ashur in the north, they moved their forces through Eretz Israel. And he went out to wage war with Egypt, not to permit them to go through Eretz Israel. There was a battle at Megiddo, and he was struck down and killed in battle. It was a day of great mourning. Sunday, Targum Yonatan says, someday there is going to be a mourning in Yerushalayim that will be equal to the 2 days of mourning. The day of mourning for Achav and the day of mourning for Yoshiyahu. That's the Gemara. So of course Rav Kook asks the questions that have to be asked on this Gemara. I mean, what's going to be this great mourning in Yerushalayim in time to come? What will be this great mourning? What's it all going to be about? Why is it going to be like the mourning for these two great people? What's so great about Achav altogether? But more important, what is it here that Yonatan ben Uzziel, what has he revealed? What great secret has he revealed? And how is it that by his revealing this secret, what did he say in his defense? I revealed this secret so that there shouldn't be machlokas by Klal Yisrael. How will this assist in there not being machlokas by Klal Yisrael? Believe me, things are going to become a great deal clearer to you. Right now, I can see you're all, well, you're floundering, but no, we're going to pick you up. Just hang in. One more Gemara. The Gemara says the following. That Hesped, that day of mourning in Yerushalayim, that's going to be the great day of mourning, is going to be mourning for Mashiach ben Yosef, who was killed in battle. There will be a Mashiach, the son of Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef is going to fall in battle. And when he falls in battle, there's going to be such mourning in Yerushalayim. It will be a terrible, terrible black day in this great city. So of course the question is, why do we need two Mashiachs? There's a Mashiach ben Yosef, and there is a Mashiach ben David. Why two Mashiachim? Why can't there be one? And what's the problem? Why is Mashiach ben Yosef going to be killed in battle? What's going to happen with Mashiach ben Yosef? Alright, now the time has come to begin to get down to business and explain everything that's happening over here, which will ultimately bring us to an understanding of Yaakov. Says Rav Kook the following: what is true in the life of the individual is true in the life of the nation. The individual human being is made up of two parts: guf, body, neshama, soul. There is the physical and the material side of man, and there is the spiritual, religious part of man, or call it the intellectual, whichever you wish. Each one of them are concerned with their own growth and development, strength, health. The body makes certain, or should make certain, that it is able to grow, yes, and to develop, and to be healthy, full of life. The soul, the spirit, is concerned with its own development, and with its own growth, and with its own flowering. One might think, mistakenly, that these two great life forces, the physical and the spiritual, are in conflict with one another. It's a collision between two great life forces. Not so. The fact is that when they learn to appreciate and understand one another, then they will find out, as Rav Kook writes in one of his other Svarim, the best of both worlds is a healthy neshama in a healthy body. And when these two great life forces learn the importance and the significance of one another, they're never in conflict, never in collision, but they complement one another. They work harmoniously together. Because the guf knows that its strength and its vitality is going to come because of the meaning that it has in life, its objective and its goal, and that is the task of the neshama. And the neshama understands that it's not going to achieve anything if there isn't going to be a healthy, strong guf. There is a sense of preservation that is built into both guf and neshama. And when the two of them work together in harmony, then you have an unbeatable combination. And when they learn that they need one another and that they are completely dependent upon one another, then you have a union of two major vital life sources that make the total human being. But there's one difference between the physical life force and the spiritual life force. The physical life force is something where Jew and non-Jew are all alike. In terms of the physical life force to develop all that is necessary for one's physical existence, this is true of all nations. It's universal throughout the world. The spiritual life force of the Jew is qualitatively and quantitatively different than that of all other people. Because the spiritual life force of the Jew is one that says, Am levado gishkon, it is a people that dwells alone. Ubagoyim lo yitchashav, we're different, we're unique, we're separate. Hashem bodod yamchenu, God is going to lead the Jewish people on a path alone, separate, distinct. So in terms of our physical life force, then we're equal to all other people. In terms of our spiritual one, we are different. These two great forces are represented by two of the tribes, two of the children of Yaakov, Yehuda and Yosef. And strangely enough, but he's right, strangely enough, the physical life force is represented by Yosef. What is Yosef? Yosef is the one who keeps an entire world alive. Who's the great administrator? Who is the one that puts together all that is necessary in order to maintain the lives of the entire Egyptian empire and his family included? In a sense, there is something about Yosef that is universal. The Gemara says that Yosef knew 70 languages. What does the Gemara mean? What they're telling us, he was a Berlitz. That's not what they're telling us. What they're telling us is that he had relationships. He was involved with the whole world because he was the one who created, and this is a word that we're going to have to use a number of times, he created the infrastructure by which a whole world was going to survive. What is Yehuda? Yehuda represents the spiritual side, the spiritual dimension of the Jewish people. We're going to see later on, it says, when Yaakov is getting ready to go down to Mitzrayim, that's Yehuda sholach lefonov lahorot. He sent Yehuda down before him in order to build a yeshiva. In other words, the one who was going to be laying the foundations of the spiritual infrastructure that was going to maintain Jewish identity and spiritual sovereignty in Egypt was Yehuda. B'tzeit Yisrael Mitzrayim, Beit Yaakov Me'am Lo'ez in Halel, Haita Yehuda L'Kodsho, the Holy One was Yehuda. Yehuda represents the spiritual life force, the Korach HaNeshama, and Yosef is the physical life force. These two qualities, these two powers, the ability to build and maintain the physical structure of the Jewish people, and the ability to build and maintain the spiritual structure of the Jewish people, the forces, the talents, the abilities of Yosef and Yehuda were united in one person, David HaMelech. There's an unusual description of David the first time that Shmuel sees this boy David. Do you know how the pasuk describes him? Admoni im yifei einayim. Admoni, he's a reiter, a redhead.
Gingy.
A gingy. Im yifei einayim, with beautiful eyes. Says the Gemara, what does this mean? Who else is an Admoni? Esav is an Admoni. The same force, the same power that Esav has, David has. But there's an added dimension to David. He has beautiful eyes. What do the eyes represent?
The soul.
The soul, but it represents more. The Gemara says it represents Sanhedrin. Yes, David is able to go out and wage war, but only al pi din, only al pi Torah. Even the physical strength of David is tempered, sanctified, and hallowed through Torah. He has the two life forces. Esav is a man of the field. He's a builder. He's a man who can do great things, but he doesn't have Torah. David has both of these forces, both of them, in one personality. And that's exactly what God's plan for the Jewish people was. In the first instance, what he wants is that the leadership of the Jewish people should be in the hands of one person who incorporates within himself both of these great dimensions, the physical and the spiritual. Just as the human body cannot survive unless the person is concerned about his physical welfare, so too the welfare of a nation cannot survive unless there's going to be a concern for its physical growth and development. A nation, just like a human being, doesn't live on air alone. A nation requires the infrastructure. Factories and industry and agriculture and army and technology, all of the great things that are necessary. You need transportation, you need mailmen, you need garbage men. You need doctors, you need lawyers. There's a whole wide spectrum of talents that are necessary in order that a people should be able to survive, just as the body has. So the original plan was that the two great life forces of Yosef and Yehuda should all be part of one human being, one leader. Avdi David, my servant David, is going to be the king upon them. because he is both Admoni, Esav-like. Remember, there's something positive about Esav. There's something positive. He's a builder. He's the man of the world. The only thing is, when this ability to build is not tempered, controlled, limited by Torah, it becomes a destructive force. But by David, it's not. By David, it... By David, it is tempered. By David, it is tempered with Torah. He is Admoni, Imifeinayim. He's Agreta, a redhead, an Edom, an Esav, but with beautiful eyes. The eyes represent Einei HaEda, the Gedolei HaTorah, who are the eyes of the congregation. The purpose of Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef becomes a necessity only when the kingdom is split. When the Jewish people reject, during the times of the kings, they reject the house of David. Then they are split into two. Who establishes the other kingdom? The other kingdom is established by Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam ben Nevat is from the tribe of Ephraim. Yerovam ben Nevat is from the family of Yosef. What is his great ability? Why does Shlomo HaMelech raise Yerovam ben Nevat to greatness? Pasuk says about him, the man was a great administrator. He got things done. Yerovam ben Nevat has the power, the talent, the ability to build. So what really happens is the 10 tribes become Yosef. And most of the kings of the 10 tribes are going to be from the family of Yosef. From Ephraim or Menashe. What's going to be the other side of the spectrum? The house of David is Yehuda. So what was supposed to be together in one person is now torn asunder. What it was at the beginning, Yosef and Yehuda. Is a very, very powerful Gemara. The Gemara says the following, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Yerovam ben Nevat and he told him, Yerovam chazor b'cha, do tshuva. What did Yerovam ben Nevat do? He had split the kingdom. 10 tribes followed him. By the way, that happened in Shechem. Geography is terribly important too. Just as Shechem in this week's Sedra, Shechem is the terrible place at which Klal Yisrael Yaakov suffers. Yaakov is going to suffer again later on in history at Shechem. At Shechem, Yerovam is going to establish the kingdom. And then what does he do in order that to make certain that Jews will not go to Yerushalayim? He establishes idols in Dan and in Beit El. Beit El. Beit El in our Sedra. Beit El. So that Jews should not go to Yerushalayim. The Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Yerovam and he says, Chazor Becha, Chazor Becha, do tshuva, Vani, Vata, Uben Yishai, Netayel B'Gan Eden. If you do tshuva, then me, you, and the son of Yishai, David, we're all going to walk together in Gan Eden. Said Yerovam to God, Mi Parosh, who's going to be first? Who's going to be at the head? Amalo, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him, Ben Yishai Parosh. Ben Yishai is going to be at the head. Yerovam's response to God was, Ihachi, if so, lo ba'ina. I don't want any part of it. Says Rav Kook, brilliantly. You know what the Gemara is saying? The Gemara is saying the following. If the two life forces that were supposed to have been in Malchus Beis David are now split, it's Yerovam and Rechavam, the 10 tribes and the two. What's going to happen over there is the physical and material life force is going to be developed to its ultimate. But what they're missing, what Yerovam is missing, is the connection with Yerushalayim and the spiritual the spiritual dimension of Yehuda. The tragedy of the division in the kingdom could have been ameliorated if the two would have learned to, one, live side by side, number two, cooperate with one another. But there's one condition. The one condition is that one has to know that it is the spiritual dimension that takes precedence. Supremacy is with neshama, not with guf. So God tells Yehovah, listen, you, I, and Ben Yishai, we're going to walk together through Gan Eden. Yehovah asks, Mi Barosh, who's going to be supreme? God tells him, Ben Yishai is going to be supreme because he represents the spiritual dimension. You represent Oretz, he represents Shomayim. There's no other way. There's no other way. He's not ready to accept it. Because he's not ready to accept it, then the tragedy of the split in the kingdom becomes a tragedy for all time. What really is happening here is the following. It should be becoming obvious right now what Rav Kook is getting to. In order to build a Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, there are two life forces that are necessary. The physical and the spiritual. You can't have a spiritual life in the luften, in the air. It has to be on solid ground. There has to be an infrastructure. There has to be a country. There has to be agriculture, industry, technology. You need it all. But that alone is not enough. All of that infrastructure must be infused with a sense of purpose. It must be complemented and sanctified and hallowed with Torah. There's something that stands higher than the physical, which is the spiritual. Yosef and Yehuda, it's Yehuda who is going to be the greater. Yeravam and Ben Yishai, it's Ben Yishai who stands higher. So of course what he's getting at is, and he says it in different words in another essay, V'olech etchem, the Pasuk says, I'm going to bring you, and we say it in Davening, God says, I'm going to bring the Jewish people, ko mimiyut, standing upright to your land. So he says, you know what the word ko mimiyut means? Comes from the word koma, a floor. You know, there's a komat karka and a komat aliyah. You have the first floor and the floor on top of it. Says Rav Kook, you can't build the floor on top if you don't have the floor on bottom. You need the komat karka. In terms of a national structure, the komat karka is the physical and material country. And on that, you build the spiritual great edifice, a Klal Yisrael that is or lagoyim, a light unto the nations. But if you don't have a country, if you don't have an army, if you don't have an industry, if you don't have technology, if you don't have a monetary system, if you don't have any of these things, you're not going to have the spiritual structure. Just as if you don't have guf, there's no place for the neshama to go. Where's the neshama going to go? It is the composite of the two, guf and neshama, body and soul together. They are what make up the total human being, and that makes up a total, complete, and healthy people. It has to be a composite of Yosef and Yehuda. It has to be David. But there was a division. There was a split. So there's still one way. Even if Klal Yisrael are divided, there is one way it can still work. If the two life forces, or the people or groups that represent the life forces, will be able to work in harmony with one another, each one will appreciate and respect the contribution of the other. If you have that, then though they are two separate and distinct groups, but they can work together in harmony and in cooperation. Shituf pu'ula. But what happens if they don't recognize the importance of the significance of one another? What happens if each one looks with suspicion and even at some point in history with hatred upon the other? Then what you are looking at is, God forbid, the destruction of a Jewish people, just as it happened in the time of the first Beit HaMikdash. Ultimately, the two kingdoms crumbled. You know why they crumbled? Because Yehuda didn't have Yosef, and Yosef didn't have Yehuda. if they would have worked together, if they would have respected one another, the two would have been able to remain side by side, but they didn't. Who were the two extreme examples of these two aspects, these two dimensions of Jewish national life? The two extreme examples were Achav and Yoshiyahu. Achav was a Rasha, but Achav was a patriot. He was a patriot. He loved Klal Yisrael. And not only that he loved Klal Yisrael, he literally gave his life for them. Aside from the fact that he was tremendously successful on the field of battle, he returned to Eretz Yisrael all sorts of lands that had been taken from their enemies. His father Omri, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, "Mipnei Mas Zocha Omri Lamalchus." Why was Omri Zocha to be king? He was also a Rasha. And if you had a son like Achav, you couldn't be much better. Why was he Zocha to be king? Says the Gemara, "Mipnei Shahosif Krach Achas Be'eretz Yisrael," because he built a city in Eretz Yisrael. He built the city of Shomron. Achav built many cities. Rasha, but he built the physical infrastructure of the Jewish people. And on the last day of his life, he goes out to war against the enemies of Israel, and a fellow by the name of Hadad Rimon shoots an arrow, and the arrow strikes Achav as he's in his chariot leading the Jewish people in battle. He tells his armor bearer who's with him in the chariot, he says, "Keep me propped up in the chariot. I don't want the people to see that I have been mortally wounded." And he remains standing propped up in his chariot all day as he loses blood, and by nightfall he's dead in the chariot. This was Mesiras Nefesh for Klal Yisrael. He knew that if he would turn his chariot around and be removed from the field of battle, Tchilas Nefila, the beginning of fall, is when king begins to move to the back lines. We're talking about a great patriot, a Rasha, but a patriot. But there was something else about this Rasha. There's another incident that is described in Tanakh. That incident is when Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, who was the one with whom he waged war for so many years, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has surrounded Shomron. This is when Shomron is weak. Early on in the career of Achav, the city is starving. Aram has captured most of Eretz Yisrael. It's the capital city that is now waiting to fall, and he sends a message to him that I want your wives, sons, daughters, gold, silver. Achav sends back a message, "It's all yours. It's all yours." Ben-Hadad sends a second message. "Not only do I want everything that I demanded before, we're upping the ante. I want kol machmadei necho, the most desirable thing that you have. When this message comes to Achav, he calls the elders of the nation together and he says, "Listen to what this man demands. I can't do that." So the elders say, "Stand your ground. Don't give in." So the Gemara asks, "The man has already told him he can have my wives, my sons, my daughters, my gold, my silver. What more could be the most desirable thing of a man's eyes? What's the most desirable thing?" Says the Gemara, "You know what? Ben-Hadad wanted the Sifrei Torah of Shomron. The Sifrei Torah he wanted. Achav the Rasha does not fulfill Torah, but he also has a sense of national pride. And he knows this fellow, if he wants the Sifrei Torah, what he really wants is he wants to wound mortally the pride of the people. And Torah is not mine to give. Maybe my wives and my children, my gold and silver, I can give, but I can't give away the Torah." So he speaks to the elders, and the elders say, "You're right. Don't." So he sends back, of course, the great message. You know, I'm always fond of quoting the American general at the Battle of the Bulge. He sends to Ben-Hadad the message, "Nuts to you. No, siree. We're not going to give the Sefer Torah, we're not going to give." And you know what happens? God goes out to the field of battle and Ben-Hadad is crushed. Achav HaRasha is worthy of great miracles, because he at least respects Torah. Achav would not have permitted a Friday night program on TV that makes fun of Torah. Guaranteed. Achav or Rasha wouldn't have permitted it. Kupach, Mupach, whoever it is, wouldn't have permitted it. He had a sense of pride. This is our Torah. It's the Torah that represents the Jewish people to the face of to the rest of this world. Achav is the extreme patriot of Guf, the physical and material growth of the Jewish people. Yoshiyahu, on the other hand, is the example of the extreme spiritual patriot, because he is the one about whom it is said in Tanakh that there were none like him who returned to God with all of their heart and all of their soul. Yirmiyahu had told him, let Paro take his forces through the land of Canaan. Don't start up with it. Yoshiyahu goes against the words of Yirmiyahu because he wants no foreign influence to come through Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is going to remain pure Torah. I don't want those Egyptians here. And he goes out to battle and he falls. He falls before the army of Paro. That pasuk in Zechariah that we started with says that someday there's going to be mourning in Yerushalayim that is going to be like the mourning for the death of Achav and the mourning for the death of Yoshiyahu. Says Rav Kook, you know what the Gemara means? You know what Yonasan ben Azil is saying? Unfortunately, God forbid, the day may come at which we're going to wake up and we're going to see that because we did not appreciate or respect the contribution of one another, we brought upon ourselves great suffering. If the religious community would understand the contribution of the secular community, and if the secular community would understand that Jewish pride is the religious community and supremacy must be with Torah, if the two would be able to work in tandem and complement one another and work harmoniously together, no force of the world can strike them down. But what happens, God forbid, if they're not going to appreciate one another? It's going to be Yosef and Yehuda, the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes all over again. Then you know what's going to happen? That great physical structure that is represented by Mashiach ben Yosef is, God forbid, going to come crumbling down. And when that happens, that Mizechatn Bamkop, we're going to look at what our terrible mistake did to us, because we didn't appreciate one another. We didn't learn that the rest of the world out there is against us, and the only way in which we're going to survive is if we learn to live with one another and appreciate one another's contribution, but with one condition. Ben Yishai Berosh. Ben Yishai has supremacy. Torah has supremacy. There's no other way. That's the only way we can. We need Guf and we need Neshama, but the Neshama is that which gives meaning and significance to everything that the Guf does. If all that the Guf is doing is just creating a country like all other countries, then we don't need it. That's not what God wanted. So he says, Bayom Hahu, Zechariah said, on that day, Yigdal HaMispeh B'Yerushalayim, the mourning in Yerushalayim is going to be that great because they will see that they made a terrible mistake. They didn't learn how to appreciate one another. And therefore let's say that the entire operation is in danger of collapse because they didn't realize it. What I want to say is the following. The first Yaakov, the first description of Yaakov, Ishtam Yoshev O'olim, the one who sits in the tents, the Ishtam, it is the one who has Torah, heaven. You can't build a people without earth. Esav is the Ish Sadeh, Ish Tzayed, he's the man of the field. He's the man who can build the physical infrastructure. Is Yitzchak fooled by Esav? He's not fooled by Esav. He's not fooled by Esav. He loves Esav and Rivka loves Yaakov. The truth is, it's no big chachmah to love Yaakov. It's easy to love Yaakov. You know what's difficult? To love an Esav. To find to find some kind of saving grace in this Esav. To be able to look at the Rosh and say, you know, he's also making an important contribution. Yitzchak is the one who takes the more difficult of the two jobs. He knows exactly what Esav is. He's not fooled for a moment. Forget that. Any thought that Yitzchak doesn't know he's old and he's blind and he doesn't know what's happening around him, sheker gomo, sheker gomo, it's not true. Yitzchak knows exactly what Esav is. And he knows that, well, maybe if he thrusts upon him the responsibility of building a great people, Esav will be able to rise to the challenge. The only thing that Rivka has going for her, she's already lived with the Rishayim. She knows what they are. She knows what they are. And more than that, do you know what Rivka is going to set out to do? She's going to take this Yaakov, who's the Ishtam, Yoshev Ohalim, the man of spirit. You know what she's going to make him into? The Ish Sadeh, the man of the field. The man of Neshama, she's going to make him the man of Guf. I command you, go out and bring the goats and take it to your father. Why does Yitzchak want to give the brachas to Esav? Because Esav can build the infrastructure. The komat karka, the bottom floor. You need the bottom floor in order to build the floor above. The floor of Neshama has to be built above the floor of Guf. Esav can do that. Yaakov can't do it. But then you know what suddenly strikes Yitzchak as Yaakov is sitting before him? Hey, this is not the same Yaakov that I once knew. Hakol kol Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, but you know what Yaakov now has? He has Yodayim that I Yidei Esav. His hands are the hands of Esav. He can build, he can create, he can make. Do you know what he sees in Yaakov now? Exactly what the Reuven sees in David. He's Admoni, he's an Edom, he's an Esav. Im yifei einayim, but with beautiful eyes. His ability to build his guf is tempered, made gentle and delicate through the eyes of Torah. Do you know what Yaakov is going to become? A man who has both powers, the powers of Yosef and the powers of Yehuda. The life force of Yosef and the life force of Yehuda. Where are Yosef and Yehuda going to get it from if not from the Tata? They're not getting it from Esav. If Yosef and Yehuda represent these two great pillars, do you know what these two pillars really are, if we want to use other words to describe them? They represent heaven and earth. Yehuda is heaven, Yosef is earth. You need heaven and earth, Guf and Neshama, in order to build the human being and in order to build the structure of a Jewish people. Yaakov, who's going to be the father of the Jewish people, has to incorporate both of them. He has to be Admoni in Yifei Einayim. And that's exactly what Yitzchak, blind old Yitzchak, sees before himself when Yaakov is sitting before him. He says, uncanny what's happened over here. Hakol kol Yaakov, the voice of the... Of course this is Yaakov. Esav doesn't talk in Yetz Hashem, Be'ezos Hashem, Rebbein Shemet Helfen. This is the voice of Yaakov. But this voice of Yaakov has the hands that are able to build like an Esav. What does Yaakov do in this week's Sedra? He goes back on the other side of the river for the little jars, the pachim ketanim that he left there. It's amazing what Chazal say, Vayivoter Yaakov Levado, Yaakov remained alone. So on the one hand, Chazal say, who else remains alone? V'nizgav Hashem Levado Bayamahu, God is going to be alone. As he is alone on the other side of the river Yabok, he represents the holiness and the divinity of God, but at the same time he's concerned about the little jars. Do you know what this is? This is the Yaakov who is the composite of Avraham and Yitzchak, Shamayim v'aretz. He's the one who sees in the dream, Sulam mutzavatza, the Rosh Magia Shamayim. He incorporates both of them. He's the Admoni Yimifei Einayim. He's Yosef and Yehuda. He comes to Shechem. Do you know what he does in Shechem? He builds the physical infrastructure that's necessary for a country to develop. They need a monetary system, he makes a monetary system. They need hygiene, they need hospitals, they need merchitzalot, house, bathhouses. He is concerned about that. Yaakov doesn't say, listen, I'm a yeshivist,
and kollelim? No. Yeshivas and kollelim and bathhouses and a monetary system? They need shvakim, they need markets. There has to be an economy. He creates a market. Yaakov is going to incorporate all of the great qualities of a David, a Yosef, a Yehuda, an Achav, a Yoshiyahu. He's going to be the bridge of heaven and earth. That's what Yaakov has to become. Where does Yaakov have to become that? You know where Yaakov has to be both of them? He has to be both of them in Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban says, in this week's Sedra, it says that Rachel dies in childbirth. Famous Ramban, where the Ramban says that the Avos fulfill Torah only in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutz Laretz. In Chutz Laretz, Yaakov was able to be married to two sisters. When he comes to Eretz Yisrael, he can't be married to two sisters anymore. Therefore, one, that's already the divine decision. Rachel dies. You know what it means? I'm taking the Ramban one step further. In Eretz Yisrael, he has to be the pillar of Torah. He has to have the life force of the Spirit. And in Eretz Yisrael also, he has to have the life force of the of body, the material strength. And therefore, at the end of last week's Sedra, the great confrontation between him and his father-in-law, where does that take place? That takes place in Chutz Laretz. Takes place in Chutz Laretz, then you know what Yaakov is? Yaakov is weak. Yaakov is unable to stand up before his father-in-law. But the moment between last week's Sedra and this week's Sedra, he crosses the border into Eretz Yisrael and he's preparing for the confrontation with Esau, it's a different Yaakov. Do you know what this Yaakov has to be now? In Eretz Yisrael, he has to be Yosef and Yehuda, Achav and Yoshiyahu, heaven and earth, Guf and Neshama. He has to be both of them. And therefore he rises to the challenge. Just as he's going to keep Torah fully in Eretz Yisrael, together with Torah comes the ability to be strong. The create, the strong physical body politic, and if necessary, the military body of a Jewish people. Yaakov is a different Yaakov in Eretz Yisrael, both in Guf and in Neshama. I think that I've answered nearly all of the questions that I asked before at the beginning of this year, except one. The fascinating story at the beginning of chapter 35 that I read, by Elohim tells Yaakov to go to Beit El and make a mizbeach there to the God who appeared to you. And Yaakov turns to his family and he says, get rid of all the idolatry that may be in your hands. Do you know what's fascinating about this? And this is a klala, a general rule that I'm just going to tell you now very quickly, and it's borne out over here. In all of Sefer Bereishis, and most probably in all of Torah, but certainly more so in Sefer Bereishis than any other place, not only are the promises of God significant, but where the promise is made. The geography is extreme. Jewish geography is extremely significant in Sefer Bereishis. At the end of Parshat Lech Lecha, God tells Avraham, kings are going to come from you. Do you know where he said it to him? He said it to him in Hebron. Where was the first Jewish kingdom established? Where was David anointed king? Hebron. Yerovam ben Nevat becomes the king of the 10 tribes. What is so terribly important about that? The fact that he represents the physical life force of the Jewish people. In what way will he succeed? He will succeed only if he appreciates and gives supremacy to the spiritual life force which is represented by Yehuda. But he doesn't do that, because in Beit El he establishes an idolatrous altar. Do you know what message Yaakov is sending? The Rebbein Shem wants him to send the message for all generations. Go to Beit El. I want you to go to Beit El. And in Beit El, I want you to establish a mizbeach. Maybe later in history they will learn from you that you have to appreciate and work together with the forces of the spiritual forces of Torah. Do you know what Yaakov is attempting to do? Maybe if he makes certain that his children remove all of their idolatry, before they go to Beit El, maybe the tragedy of Beit El will be averted. And if the tragedy of Beit El is not averted in the days of Yeravam, maybe it will be averted in the 20th century. Maybe at some later point in history, the two segments that make up the Jewish people, those who are concerned with the physical and material development, and those who are concerned with the spiritual and Torah development, will learn to live together and appreciate one another. I don't know why, while I was thinking about this, I read one of my weaknesses, I read the paper. So I just read this morning in the Hatzofer, just a quote. After we're finished with the quote, then we'll tell you who said it. Hamivchan ha'elyon shel medinat Yisrael, the great test of the state of Israel, yihyeh, will be lo bekorach tzva'a, not in the strength of her army, lo biyecholta hamishkit, not in her ability, her economic ability in the meshek, v'lo b'mispar uchlaseha, and not with the number of people who live here. Im ki kol eile kashuvim, le'ein adoch, even though all of these are terribly important. Terribly important. We need them all. U'matnim ki yumah v'atidah, the existence of the state and its future depends on population, on economy, and on the military. But that's not going to be its ultimate test. Mibchanaha mitiva ha'elyon, the real and supreme test shel medinat Yisrael, hi baruach, is going to be in the spirit of this state. B'nei emunatam, will they remain faithful li'yudim ha'gedolim shel ha'nevi'im, to the great destiny that was said by the prophets. B'chazonam la'acharet hayamim, and to their great vision of the end of days. Isn't this, doesn't this sum up the whole shiur that I said? Ben Gurion. One moment. Masha, she helped me. I asked, what did he learn in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva? So I say, Torah he learned it by his father Avram and Yitzchak. To build a world and a society. Guf, he learned in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva. Ruach, he learned in the yeshiva of Avraham and Yitzchak. How do you? Thanks, Masha. Okay. How do I know that?
Why don't you have faith in your Rebbe?
Could Shem Ve'eva teach him Torah? He couldn't learn Torah from Avraham and Yitzchak? You know what? I'll prove it to you. I believe it's Rabbi Yankel Kamenetsky that writes in his Sefer in one place, he writes that Shem Ve'eva prepared him for life in the world. Because he knows that when he flees from his father's house, he's going to go out into the great big world over there. That he's going to learn from Shem Ve'eva. Doesn't have to learn. He doesn't have to learn Torah. He's not going to learn a Rambam by Shem Ve'eva.
Rabbi, what was in the jars?
Huh?
What was in the jars?
What was what?
In the jars.
In the jars. They were empty jars. Just jars. They belonged to him. And you don't leave something behind.